We've had Dennis here before, so I know many of you remember him. Dennis Rivers is a writer, a computer programmer, and an ecology activist deeply interested in liberation theology and the study of living systems. In the 1970s, he studied religious studies and sociology at UCSB, and he also studied theology at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. He counts among his most inspiring teachers Ramon Panikkar, just like Ernie, also Walter Capps, a familiar name here, Marshall Rosenberg, and Joanna Macy, who was one of the authors in this book, as you noticed. And Dennis repeated what Ernie had said, that they have been friends for over 40 years. So with no more ado, to you, Dennis.
Well, I'm really happy to be here today. I found this topic very difficult to wrestle with. I think because it's connected to everything. It's like almost like all the important human ideas in human life are connected to all the other important big ideas in human life. So when you grab a hold of one, you're really dealing with all of them. I wanted to start with just a little background of Gaia theory and James Lovelock. James Lovelock was working not far from here. He was working at Caltech in Pasadena, I guess in the late 60s or early 70s. He was part of a team that was trying to figure out how to discover whether there's life on other planets. And he came up with, he had the realization that life forms change the atmosphere of a planet so that you could tell whether or not there was life on a planet by when the starlight would go by the planet, it would sort of illuminate the atmosphere and it would tell you what sort of gases were in the atmosphere, and you could reason backwards and figure out what kind of, there were some sort of organisms on the planet because the organisms and the planet had become a kind of stable system. And that was the beginning of this idea of Gaia, that the whole world is a kind of interwoven system that has an equilibrium that protects life. That the various parts of the process, the ocean, the atmosphere, the minerals and the rocks, and the life forms themselves all interact in a complex balancing way. This became the Gaia hypothesis, but it turns out that inside the Gaia hypothesis there were three or four hypotheses depending on how you read it, because you could read it that the Earth is a kind of a large, carefully balanced mechanical system, that life is a more complex mechanical system, or you could read the Gaia hypothesis that a planet with life is a kind of living being. And so people embraced the Gaia hypothesis from wherever they were in relation to those that spectrum of possibilities. I have to smile. As I read this chapter, I had a hard time with the chapter because I'm not a Jungian. And as I read the chapter, I was kind of thinking, well, you know, in the face of a great emergency, people do more of what they already know how to do. So when there's a great crisis, the bikers have a bike-a-thon, and the people who can bake, bake cookies, and the Jungians deliver deep lectures about the archetypes of the collective unconscious. I felt very superior for about 10 minutes. And then I realized, yes, Dennis, and grumpy socialists deliver diatribes against capitalism. Oh, dear. I hope that you will bear with this diatribe because there's fruitful material in it. So my talk today is going to be, what is the spiritual significance of Gaia theory? I am convinced that we are searching for a way to connect with the earth precisely because we have somewhat lost our connection with the earth. The successes of industrial society have allowed us to live, at least temporarily, in protected enclaves far away from where the earth is being damaged. But with industrially produced global warming, that protection is now breaking down. Warmer weather, more mosquitoes, Zika virus starts to appear in California. All this reminds us with sudden force that we are part of a larger world and vulnerable to its troubles. Her troubles are our troubles. As I read the news with Gaia in mind, I'm struck by two more examples. In Appalachia, entire mountains are being demolished in order to extract the coal that lies inside them. The resulting terrain of cold field rubble poisons the rainwater that washes through it. They call this way of mining mountaintop renewal. And a mountaintop removal, although they think they're going to renew it by prettying up the landscape afterwards. Can a mountain have a right to exist? Do we have the right to destroy everything in our path? In Alberta, Canada, there are approximately 50,000 square miles, something the size of Ireland, of subsurface oil-bearing tar sands. Deposits that U.S. and Canadian oil companies are determined to dig up every last shovel full of and turn into oil. Both the digging up of the tar sands and the burning of the oil produced are not good for the earth, and they're not good for us. Giant stretches of Alberta already now look like a moonscape, a terrain no longer capable of supporting life. So our insulation from the bad news of out-of-control industrialization is wearing thin. We hear news about the sixth great extinction of species on planet Earth, and we begin to wonder, what's going on? And how could we possibly respond? Gaia theory is important, in my view, not because it is technically accurate. There are many controversies about that. But because it is an effort in Western culture to understand the wider webs of connectedness that weave us into the life of planet Earth. The great myth of most industrialized societies, including the United States, is that unlimited private greed will produce unlimited private public good. Thus, individuals do not have to look out and survey the impact of their actions on a wider world. They can know axiomatically that whatever they are doing to make money must necessarily be making the world a better place. We're losing the projector. I will give the projector a little boost. Must necessarily be making the world a better place. Greed is good, said the movie villain Gordon Gekko. The shorthand name for this idea is the wisdom of the market. Anything sold in the market, military assault rifles, child pornography, antidepressants that don't work, whatever, adds to the gross national product, and through the market's mysterious and miraculous inner workings, eventually makes us all wealthier and happier. This idea is held as such a deep article of faith for large numbers of people that no amount of evidence seems to be capable of causing doubt. I have an intuition that a deeply held article of faith cannot be dislodged with evidence. It can only be replaced, hopefully, by a more noble article of faith. This wisdom of the market idea goes along quite well with the kind of science that chops things into the smallest conceivable pieces and then meticulously documents the nature and behavior of each tiny piece that can be separated. We have a science that has been steeped in separation for several centuries and has only slowly begun to turn via ecology and systems theory in the direction of webs of connectedness. The focus on tiny bits of things has allowed us to ignore troubling signals from the web of connectedness, such as the signals that Rachel Carson documented in her book, Silent Spring. What did it mean that the songbirds were silent? What did it mean that they were gone? I'm afraid that the scientists who helped make DDT were not out there creeping around in the bushes trying to understand why the songbirds were gone. They were narrowly focused on the problems they had originally tried to solve. Only a vision of connectedness would cause a person to ask new questions about DDT and all of its various cohorts. When I think of examples of evidence that become socially or culturally invisible, three items come to mind out of the hundreds or even thousands that I could list, but for your sake, I'm not going to list this morning. Item number one, it was well established by 1900 that the lead pigment in white paint was toxic. But American paint manufacturers fought off the banning of lead pigments for 75 years, very probably causing some degree of brain damage to millions of young children. Oh, the wondrous workings of the market! Give praise, ye earthlings! More than 20 manufacturers of baby formula in China decided to boost the apparent protein content of their baby formula products with powdered white melamine plastic, the same stuff that makes your sturdy kitchen plates. 300,000 babies were affected. 54,000 were hospitalized. Oh, the wondrous workings of the market! Stop griping, ye earthlings! Item number three. Probably many of you remember the Ford Pinto, which Ralph Nader made famous in a book entitled Unsafe at Any Speed. The Pinto had a badly designed and badly located gas tank that would easily burst into flame, even in low-speed accidents, and incinerate the occupants of the car. But the badly designed gas tank boosted Ford's profits by saving $11 on the manufacturing cost of each car. Oh, the wondrous workings of the market. You see, if unlimited private greed must necessarily produce unlimited public good, these kinds of events simply can't be happening. So they must not have happened. Or there's some little bizarre, freakish anomaly that we really don't need to pay attention to. This, I submit, is the way guiding myths work. Events that do not fit into the storyline become invisible. They get voted off the island. They become alien truths. They fall into a kind of cognitive limbo, a cultural underworld where they wander forever unrecognized. The reason that Gaia theory is culturally important is because Gaia theory, imperfect though it may be, points toward a very different story, a story of deep connectedness, a story about our lives that turns our attention outward to embrace a world of interwoven complexity. It is a world that includes lots more than the balance sheets of oil and auto companies. It includes all of our many brothers and sisters in the tree of life. It includes all the cooperating strands in the complex weaving of life, the minerals and the gases in the atmosphere. It includes all of the creatures, great and small, that swim in the seas of the planet. And last but not least, it includes all the consequences of our own activities on the surface of the planet, because we are now the dominant species on planet Earth. And we are now the kind of the guiding force, for better or for worse, in the changes that are happening on the Earth. In relation to that interwoven web of life, one giant implication stands out to me above all others. And that implication is this: we cannot just do on the face of the earth whatever we darn well please. Making peace with that implication is going to require a revolution of the heart and mind. The sort of revolution of heart and mind that Pope Francis outlined in his recent encyclical Laudato Si. If the world is just a collection of dead bits of this and that, then we can do with it whatever we please. If the world is a community of living participants and supportive strands, then we will need to think very, very seriously and carefully before we drill a hole in something, because that something is, in a way we may not fully understand, also a someone. The 20th century philosopher Martin Buber describes the human self as always a mix of the two most fundamental relationships: I-thou, in which I recognize you as having value in and of yourself and worthy of care, and I-it, in which I relate to someone or something as having no inherent integrity, as existing only to be used for me, for my ends. We've all seen how that works out in everyday life, and it is just as unhappy on the giant stage of the world. Thomas Berry describes a central part of the great work of our time as moving from the idea of the universe as a collection of objects to the universe as a community of subjects, quite parallel to Buber's vision from many decades before. This vision of connectedness, which has been held by native peoples for millennia, is in deep conflict with our current economic system, which tends to turn everything under the sun into an it to be used and discarded. And thus, our current economic system is in deep conflict with the integrity of life on planet Earth. So, we have enormous and beautiful and creative work before us. Creative work that writers such as Joanna Macy have called the Great Turning. The Great Turning will be a turning from isolation to connectedness. The Great Turning will be a turning from greed to generosity. The Great Turning will be a turning from numbness to compassion. The Great Turning will be a turning from tiny bits to whole systems, the whole family. The Great Turning will be a turning from domination to compassion. And the Great Turning will also be a turning from seemingly convenient ignorance. It seems convenient to us to ignore, as long as we can, the feedback we're getting from the Earth that our way of dealing with is not working. Seemingly convenient ignorance to carefully observant wisdom. That sounds like a spiritual path to me. Sounds like an extension, a modern version of the prayer of St. Francis. Where I was isolated, may I get more connected. Where I myself was preoccupied with greed, may I now blossom with generosity. Where I was numb, may I be filled with compassion. Where I was obsessed with tiny bits that allowed me to ignore a lot of bad news that was going on out there, may I embrace the whole family. A similar feeling. Many of the controversies about Gaia theory focus on the issue of what counts as a living organism. Then people get involved in various technical arguments about biology and about the circulation of gases in the atmosphere, and more arguments about whether the Earth is a conscious being who has intentions toward us. But I want to invite you to wrestle with a different question, a question that I see as even more valuable. It is not the question of what are the Earth's intentions toward us. It's the question of what are our intentions toward the Earth. I am convinced that the personal and cultural intentions, levels, our intentions, are now as important as the biology and geology. As Clive Hamilton argues in his recent book, Defiant Earth, the enormous successes of that human beings have had through industrialization have had enormous side effects as well, influencing the biology, the oceans, and even the geology of planet Earth. So the questions people ask and the stories they live by, previously thought of as not part of science, now they are central elements in the Earth's evolutionary journey, for better or for worse. If you doubt this, consider that the state of Arkansas now has several thousand earthquakes a year as a result of the bedrock fracturing practices of oil drilling companies. The geology of earthquakes must now include human influences and even nutty economic theories like the wisdom of the market. Several thousand earthquakes a year in Arkansas? Stop the world. I want to get off. Oklahoma also. From my point of view, it is better to understand Gaia theory, not so much as an answer, but as a pointer. As our most recent camping spot on the long journey toward understanding interwovenness. May we all participate in the unfolding of a new cultural story about interwovenness, a beautiful, inspiring story that will keep us from wrecking the planet and will help us from destroying ourselves. May our intentions toward Gaia be to become nurturing fellow gardeners in the garden of life. Thank you. Now, I want to do some exercises and answer questions and stuff for the rest of my time.
Sure.
I have until 10 of.
Yeah.
Great. Wonderful. Great. So, I would like to spend our remaining time together in two parts. First, I'd like everyone here to please find, make groups of four, and please pick some people that you haven't talked so much to in the past. Although in this group, people have known each other for a long time. Please assemble in groups of four, and pass a talking stick or a talking pencil or a talking ballpoint pen around, take turns, and discuss with your partners the question, how is life calling me to become a gardener of life? How is life calling me to participate in the healing and the unfolding, the healing of life and the unfolding of the planet? Thank you so much. And then I'll keep time. We'll do that for about 10 minutes. Thank you. So I just want to repeat the instructions for all of our discussion groups, that the question that we're circulating around the group is, for each of us, how is life calling me to participate in the mending of the world, to participate in the unfolding of life? Thank you. Thank you so much for participating in these circles of discussion. And I'd like to call us all back into our larger group this morning. And how is life calling us? That's the wonderful question. How is life calling us? These great challenges surface in each of our lives as the question of our calling, because we are part of this amazing web of life, and my breath is the earth breathing through me. As the Zen philosopher Alan Watts once remarked, the outline of you is the inline of the rest of the entire universe. You are what the universe is doing at this particular moment in time, this particular place. So I would like to offer the microphone to anyone here, to everyone here, to give us some questions and comments.
Can I read something instead?
Yes. Yes.
When I was reading, especially the Gaia Hypothesis, it made me recall. You can hear me, can't you? No?
Closer.
Okay. When I was reading the Gaia Hypothesis, I couldn't help but remember a poem that came to me in the summer of 1988, and I wrote it, but it wasn't my poem. I actually had kind of an automatic writing experience. My father had died a few months ahead of time, and that summer of 88, I was a little bit of a different person, let's say, put it that way. Anyway, I really wanted to read this to you because of Gaia. And I didn't write this, remember that. Tell me about the garden of life, the garden that is my life, that is me, that makes me up, that makes up me, the count that contains me, that nurtures me, that produces me, that I make, that I think of, my garden of me. The world as a garden, the universe as my garden of endless variation and change and source of all, my garden of me. Textures, colors, hues, surfaces, depths, lightness and darkness, fresh and stagnant, laughing brooks, thundering waves, deep quiet pools, broad rivers, calm lakes, frothy water, dark seas, heavy troughs, all of me. Jagged peaks, high cliffs, rolling hills, deep valleys, grassy knolls, sandy beaches, dry riverbeds, rocky points, all are me. Slashing knives, ripping flesh, hysterical laughter, endless tears, all are me. Blue skies, white clouds, pelting rain, gentle showers, soft breezes, fierce winds, forked lightning, violent thunder, gales and glaring rays, all are me. The birds, the snakes, the cats, the fish, the furry ones, the scaly ones, the loved ones, the quiet ones, the happy ones, the sad ones, the mad ones, the human ones, all are me. Tell me about the garden of life, the life as a garden, my life. I am the garden, my garden, all that is me.
I love being here. I love discussing this topic with people. So I'm just in heaven hearing people respond to this stuff about the garden of life. Yes.
Could I throw out just one quick and provocative question?
Yes.
Which is, you speak of the fabric of the universe. And my reflection in my question is, do you think that women are the best weavers of this fabric? And what do the women think? Because I think you are, actually. I think you know how to build community better than men do. And that's why so many of you are here.
Well, I do want to say, I got half the DNA in my body from a woman. So, but I do think that in different societies, in certainly many, many places, women are encouraged to take up more caring roles, so that it's funny, after all these years of trying to discover, is it nature or is it nurture, just thousands of academic papers written and hundreds of books, what have they come up with? It's about half and half, folks. So I agree with you that women, as we greet them today, are more nurturing and more gardeners of the garden of life. But I think that's because they've been steered and encouraged in that direction, and men have had guns put in their hands and said, become a man, go out and shoot those people, prove you're a man by killing someone, which is a terrible way to get going as a sensitive soul. Now, other questions and comments?
I'd love a copy of what you just read about that the earth is me. And I do think that that summed up the morning. So thank you for sharing that, and if we could get copies.
And thank you all for being here this week as you walk through life. May you encourage the unfolding of compassion and delight in every heart you encounter.
Thank you, Dennis. Thank you, Ernie. What a rich morning this has been. And I just want to remind you that next week we will have a presentation on the sacred presence of animals, reawakening our interconnection with all of creation. Boy, does that seem like a good follow-up for today. And this will be with Mary Ann Evans, who is a neuropsychologist and an equine therapist. So I think we'll enjoy that.